This thing having a purpose, human rebirth is the basic motivation, and the second scope is wanting to be liberated from samsara. And today we're entering the third scope where we're going to focus on altruistic intention, the motivation to free everyone from every kind of suffering and to benefit others by becoming a Buddha. And so we're on pages 42 through 48. The next month the talk will be on act of compassion. And then the other topics in the book then kind of split into kind of like very practical items. And so the November one will be practical guidelines for good living, and the December talk will be on directing our energy positively, which actually takes us through page 78. And then next year we'll go through the rest of the book. So that's kind of the basic plan and where we've been. So today, so we're entering the topics on bodhicitta. And this is really the essence of Mahayana Buddhism, or the great vehicle. And in my mind, it's quite well expressed by one of the verses from the 37 practices of a bodhisattva, which is, when your mothers who've loved you since time without beginning are suffering, what use is your own happiness? Therefore, to free limitless beings, develop the altruistic intention. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about today will be really brought out from this verse. And for instance, the definition really, what makes a bodhisattva, is the first moment where someone has this awakening mind of bodhicitta spontaneously. That's when you first enter the bodhisattva path. The first path, which is the path of accumulation. And even then, bodhicitta isn't quite stable yet. When you get a little farther on in that path, then it becomes more stable and irreversible. So even Shantideva addresses this. He says, and this is from the first chapter, which talks about the benefits of the awakening mind, or bodhicitta, or the altruistic intention. From the time that one adopts that spirit with an irreversible attitude for the sake of liberating limitless sentient beings, from that moment on, an uninterrupted stream of merit equal to the sky constantly arises, even when one is asleep or distracted. Which sounds quite good to me. So how can one measure the merit of the jewel of the mind, which is the seed of the world's joy and is the remedy for the world's suffering? So the first chapter from Shantideva really is just so beautiful, the way it talks about bodhicitta. But I think first we need to kind of have a sense of what bodhicitta is. And so the brief answer is, it's the wish to become enlightened in order to benefit others, sentient beings. But Geshe Tekcho talks in the book Transforming Adversity into Joy and Courage, and and Tsongkhapa and some others are really very clear on this, that it's really important to understand exactly what bodhicitta is so that we can generate it properly. And so this is what they describe. It's a primary consciousness which has two aspirations. So you have the aspiration that's intent on benefiting sentient beings, and you have the aspiration that's intent on enlightenment. So first we aspire to benefit others, and then we become aware that even though we have this intention, we become aware that we're not capable yet of doing it. And within that, we recognize the qualities of the Buddha and the and that these qualities actually allow you to help others most effectively. So the Buddha has an omniscient mind, so the Buddha actually is in the best position to help others, because the Buddha can actually know the various interests and dispositions and even their past karmic connections with others. And so recognizing the qualities of the Buddha and of enlightenment, once we realize that, then if we're already kind of on board with this wish to help others, then we'll generate this heartfelt wish that I must become enlightened and definitely have to do this. And so the the primary consciousness or the mind that comes together with that aspiration is what bodhicitta is. So then they describe kind of what it isn't, which I think helps to clarify it. So it's not just having a kind heart. That's not actually bodhicitta. And it's not just the aspiration to benefit others, and it's not just the aspiration to become a Buddha. It's actually, it has to have those combined. The aspiration to benefit others is like the cause. And this occurs prior to the aspiration to want to become enlightened. It doesn't occur at the same time. And I think the reason they make that distinction is because when you do meditation on this, the object at that point in bodhicitta is enlightenment. It's not sentient beings, whereas when you're meditating on compassion, the object is sentient beings. So it's important to be quite clear. So when based on that, this is what Geshe Tekshar says, when based on that aspiration to benefit all beings, we generate a primary consciousness with the aspiration to become a Buddha, then we have generated full-fledged bodhicitta. So I'll talk about these things kind of generally at first. The readings for this month primarily went through one of the methods to develop bodhicitta, which was the 7-point cause and effect instructions. And I'll get into that later, but I first wanted to talk more in general about the different, about bodhicitta and about the different, kind of the different steps of those 7 steps, more talking more in general first about before we put them all together. So in the first chapter from Shanti Deva's Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, I mean, I could have picked many of the verses out of there because it's just filled with things that are quite inspiring. I just picked the ones that spoke to me, I guess. And so I'm going to read verses 5 through 13. And it just gives us a sense, just a taste of, with someone's poetic ability, of what bodhicitta is. And you have to put this in perspective, you know. We've all had teachings before, so you have to have in mind all of the teachings that we've already gone through, the teachings about renunciation and all the problems and samsara and the various kinds of sufferings, and then the teachings on liberation, so you have some sense that there's a solution. You have to have that whole mix in there to really come to the place of bodhicitta. So I think that will be clear by some of these verses. So this is from the first chapter in Shanti Deva, which is entitled The Benefit of the Spirit of Awakening, which is bodhicitta. Just as lightning illuminates the darkness of a cloudy night for an instant, in the same way that by the power of the Buddha, occasionally people's minds are momentarily inclined towards merit. That's how occasional it is. Thus virtue is perpetually ever so feeble, while the power of vice is great and extremely dreadful. Do you believe that? I do. If there were no spirit of perfect awakening, what other virtue would overcome it? The lords of sages, which I think means the holy beings or the Buddhas, who have been contemplating for many eons, have seen this alone as a blessing by which joy is easily increased and immeasurable multitudes of beings are rescued. Those who long to overcome the abundant miseries of mundane existence, those who wish to dispel the adversities of sentient beings, and those who yearn to experience a myriad of joys should never forsake the spirit of awakening. When the spirit of awakening has arisen, in an instant, a wretch who is bound in the prison of cyclic existence is called a child of the Sugatas, or a bodhisattva, and becomes worthy of reverence in the worlds of gods and humans. Upon taking this impure form, it transmutes it into the priceless image of the gem of the Jina, so firmly hold the quicksilver elixir called the spirit of awakening, which must be utterly transmuted. The world's soul leaders, whose minds are fathomless, have well examined its great value. You, who are inclined to escape from the states of mundane existence, hold fast to this jewel of the spirit of awakening. Just as a plantain tree decays upon losing its fruit, so does every other virtue wane. But the tree of the spirit of awakening perpetually bears fruit and does not decay and only flourishes. Owing to its protection, as due to the protection of a powerful man, even after committing horrendous vices, one immediately overcomes great fears. Why do ignorant or deluded beings not seek refuge in it? So many things are covered in that. You know, some of them that really speak to me is that how, like the last verse, for example, overcoming great fears. Venerable has told us a number of times that the teachings that resonate most strongly with inmates are the teachings on, one of those teachings are the teachings on bodhicitta. And, you know, oftentimes people that we've met that are in prison have, some of them have murdered people, some of them have done some things that aren't so great. And we have also done things that aren't so great. And we have a lot of, you know, reactions to that. But I think this really, no matter what we've done in our life, all of that can be overcome. And this focus of attention in your life actually can completely dispel all fears. And then working backwards a little bit, it's just as a plantain tree decays upon losing its fruit, so does every other virtue wane. That's because we can burn up every other virtuous activity. The karma from any virtue can meet its result and then be extinguished. But any activities that we do that are held with the intention of bodhicitta will continue until you reach enlightenment. And by then you probably won't need that merit anymore. Beyond it. Go on. So basically, trying to, you know, that's a huge thing, because we're always creating karma, and our karma is always ripening and finishing, and it's just kind of continually happening. But to have, this is like the sure proof, I don't know the exact word for that, kind of motivation to have. It's so vast and so extensive. It includes every being. So it won't really be able to finish until every being has been brought to full enlightenment. So those are just some things that try to describe the advantages, and we need to look at these things, because we want to make joyful effort in this regard, and it's always helpful to understand both the advantages and the disadvantages of things when you want to kind of move in a direction. Most of the chapter, actually, though, was about the seven cause and effect instructions. And so basically, there are two different methods described in the teachings to cultivate bodhicitta. And one is the seven cause and effect, or 7-point cause and effect instructions, and the other is equalizing and exchanging self for others. And both of these are have scriptural, you know, texts that they were described in. What's true for both of those methods, that they both have the same cause. The principal cause of bodhicitta, which is the end result of those methods, is great compassion. So compassion is kind of the key. And so then how do we go about generating compassion? And this is really based on seeing other people as pleasing and lovable, seeing their beauty, and cultivating a genuine affection for others. Because unless we can see people in a positive light, it would be quite difficult to generate genuine compassion for them. And this is what I've been kind of sitting with, these teachings on love and compassion the last few days, and which is not new. This last year I've spent some time thinking about mostly about love. And I find that it's quite mixed in my own experience, mostly mixed. There's only a few examples that I really can pick out that I think are actually meet the criteria that I read here. So I'm enjoying these teachings for that reason, because I think that, as one thing Tsongkhapa said, which is, I found quite useful. So he said that the mind stream, which has been infused since beginningless time with the bitter afflictions, will not change at all from just a short cultivation of the good qualities of love, compassion, and so forth. And that's been, I think, my experience, you know, having only met the Dharma in 2000 and only spent a very little amount of time thinking about love and compassion, really, and looking at my own experience with the criteria that we come to for this, and I think, yeah, this is true. So he says that you have to sustain this kind of meditation continuously. And unless that we have the points correct, that we'll have a difficult time getting the proper result. And so I think that's just their advice for us, which is, I think, well said. So how do we develop a compassion that is strong? And there are two main things that this depends on. One is seeing the person or others as lovable and feeling close to them, kind of like what we think of with this holiness, who is just so there with everyone. And then also, it depends also on the depth of our understanding of that person's suffering and of suffering in general. So if either of those is weak or missing, then there won't be like a vitality or even a genuineness necessarily to the compassion that we generate. So this takes us then to, well, how do we generate love and compassion? And so in one of the methods, of these two methods, in the 7-point cause and effect instructions, the first 3 points are what are trying to get us to that place. So in that one, in that method, the first point is that of those is we recognize that all sentient beings have been our parents in previous lives. So we try to generate this, we try to contemplate about the kindness of our parents and especially our mother. And this assumes we've had good relationships. If that isn't the case, then you want to probably pick maybe a caretaker or someone who is very kind to you and helped to raise you. But basically, what we're trying to do there is trying to generate that heartfelt feeling of closeness. And even in the Tibetan language, they have the, when they describe a sentient being, their actual translation is mother sentient being. And I think it might even be kind mother sentient being. So we try to... in that meditation, you start with that point of reference, which for many of us, we would choose our mother. Some people might choose a caretaker. And then after recognizing, we try to recognize that all beings have been our parents in previous lives. Well, that, you know, right there in our culture might be a little hard because you have to have some feel for rebirth, but just assume that. Once you recognize that all beings have been our parents, and then you think about the kindness of your mother, naturally this wish will come to want to repay kindness. And that's, I think, kind of the good news. If you look at how we function as human sentient beings, that it's once we recognize the kindness of others, this feeling of wanting to repay their kindness and reciprocate it is just a natural. That's, we have that going for us. And so basically, those 3 steps, recognizing that all sentient beings have been our parents in previous life, contemplating the kindness of our parents, and especially the mother, and that wishing to repay their kindness, those 3 steps are what are trying to lead us to this place of what they call a heartwarming love, for a deep affection. And this is the kind of closeness that we're looking for that will help us to develop compassion. So that's how it's done in that method. In the other method, the equalizing and exchanging self for others, that method uses more of a kind of reasoning. So I think the first one is kind of a, more comes out of a, I would even call it a little sense of devotion almost, because it's kind of an emotional thing. At least for me, when I think of my mother, I don't have to use any logic, it just kind of comes. The other one is more by reasoning, but it's still taking you to a heartfelt place. And so this is where we look that all beings have been kind to us. And so it's not even just our mother or our friends, but we use reasonings like we did this morning to how we kind of broke down friend, enemy, and stranger. We actually use reasonings to see that everyone has been kind to us. And why, how could we ever get to that point of thinking that? Well, it's because everything that we know and have comes due to others. There's nothing, if you analyze, there's nothing that you have or that you can do that isn't due to the kindness of others. Everything in this room, everything we're eating, all the clothes we have, the bodies we have come from our parents, and all the food we've eaten. I mean, you just, you know, it's, everything comes from that. So we see that, and then also we see that everyone wants to be happy and no one wants to suffer. And then all the meditations that we have on seeing the advantages of cherishing others and the disadvantages of our self-centered thought, all of these come together. And, you know, like the self-centered attitude that we carry, these kind of thoughts, they're just hugely miserable. You know? I mean, they cause so much unhappiness within ourselves, so much misery. And so all of those meditations that you do, they just help to turn your mind and turn your mind. And then when you see your own situation and then you see everyone's in the same boat, that's the way, that's the method in the equalizing and exchanging self for others that we generate love and compassion for all beings. So that's kind of the general ideas that are kind of relate to both methods. This feeling, getting to the place of a, what they call heartwarming love, which is a really a genuine, heartfelt affection, just feeling close. And, you know, to me, that's so, I've been watching my mind, and I just paying attention to that alone is what really what I've been focusing on, and I just see how my moods affect it so much. It's just really funny. The cats pretty much stay in the category of having my affection. And then all everyone else I contact, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's completely depend on my state of mind. It's just crazy. It's just like the meditation we did this morning. So this is why before you can start either of these two methods, you have to start with equanimity. This is where it's before you start either the 7-point cause and effect instructions, which, you know, one cause leads to effect, one cause leads to effect. It would just, it's like a cookbook. If you can actually do this over enough time, that will happen. And or the equalizing, exchanging self for others, the reasonings will just carry you to that place. But before you can even step on board with that, you have to have a mind that has more equanimity. Like the meditation we did this morning, everything was so self-reference. They're my friend because they're nice to me. They're my enemy because they make me unhappy. They're a stranger because I don't really care. They don't affect me. They don't affect me, so I don't care. You know, you can't be functioning. Mostly I'm functioning on that level. This is what, you know, why I have to keep doing the meditations to get beyond that. And so even just understanding that intellectually and then the small experiences that you have during the meditations, it's quite clear that the method will lead to a good result. So what is the kind of equanimity that we want to develop in order to do these methods to develop bodhicitta. It's basically an evenness of mind and a kind of impartiality, but it's not, doesn't have indifference. So I can kind of be impartial, but if I look at it closely, I'm oftentimes just checked out, indifferent. So this is quite different from that. It's an evenness of mind. An impartiality where you're not self-referencing and categorizing everyone like you do in the friend, enemy, and stranger. So backing up a little bit, in Buddhism, the word equanimity is used in different ways in different places. And sometimes it's confusing, so I find this helpful to review. There are three main kinds of equanimity three main places where you come across that word. Only one of those is the one that we're referring to here. So I'll explain the other two. Sometimes we talk about equanimity when we're talking about calm abiding meditation or serenity. And this is the kind of equanimity where a disturbing, or some kind of distraction comes up and you decide not to apply any antidotes or anything, you just let everything go. You desist from that because they're not necessary. And so you just stay in this kind of equanimity that watches something arise, realizing that you can stay with your object just fine and you don't need to change gears, pull out any antidotes, and deal with it. That's one meaning of equanimity related to meditative concentration. And then there's the other time where when we talk about the feeling aggregate, you know, how we have the five aggregates, and one of them is feeling, which is the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings that, you know, when you contact, there's contact and then feeling. Is everybody following me on this? Okay, so you have the five aggregates. That one, that neutral feeling is also sometimes called equanimity or feeling of equanimity. That's also not what we're talking about here. This particular equanimity for bodhicitta is the one that is more the one that we say when we say the four immeasurables. So we say, you know, all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. May they be free of suffering in its causes. May they not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May they abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. That's the equanimity that we're talking about here. So sometimes they call it immeasurable, or saw another word for that as well. Immeasurable equanimity. So even in that, there are two types. So one is like where we're wishing others to be free from these, like in the four immeasurables, we say, you know, may all sentient beings be, you know, have equanimity. May they be free of bias, attachment, and anger. But actually here, it's the second one where we ourselves are trying to be impartial. We're talking to ourselves now. We have to free our own minds from attachment and hostility and apathy. This is the state of mind we need to even that we need to work on in order to generate bodhicitta. We have to be free from really gross attachments to friends and relatives. We have to be free of apathy to strangers and free of hostility to enemies or people who we don't like or threaten us, or, you know, people that we think have crazy, ridiculous ideas. Those are, this, we use the word enemy for that, basically difficult people. Because if we aren't able to be more impartial in those situations, then our compassion will just be partial. We'll only have it for the people that we are attached to, that we're attracted to. We won't have it for everyone. So we have to level the playing field a little bit more. And also our compassion then won't be stable, because if we only are having compassion for the people that we like, well, we've already seen friends, enemies, and strangers are moving around like Mexican jumping beans. So in one day, somebody can be all three, you know. And so that would not be a very stable compassion unless you could hold it for all of those. So this is why we have to develop this mind of equanimity. So really, genuine compassion requires that we have a broad view, seeing all sentient beings as equal. And so, you know, I think then which method you would use, I mean, I think there's a way where they combine the two. For me, I kind of use both. I mean, I like parts of both. It's a little difficult for me to do them, seeing every being as my mother, although I like playing around with it. I mean, Atisha used to say that. Everyone he met, dear mother, you know, he just called everyone his mother, and he trained his mind that way. And it was quite a beautiful thought. I find it personally a little easier to think about how everyone is suffering and everyone wants to be free. We're all equal in that way. And I think there's in Geshe Tekchak's book, I think in there, they combine these two. So there's a way to kind of use all of them. So we want to have this broad view. So that means we have to reflect about how we're categorizing people, you know, and how unstable that is. You know, I mean, we have to, I think the reasoning of this is so quick to see. It doesn't take too much to see how just a small little thing can quickly make somebody go from one category to another. I mean, everyone's had that experience. It's so easy to see. I mean, how stable is that? And just like in the meditation, if someone, I can't remember how it was, if somebody's nice to you today, mean to you tomorrow, you know, and then they flip roles, I mean, it's just so unstable. Or if we just base our compassion and our caring on this fondness that we have for others, well, that's not going to be very stable. If that's what it's based on, you know, how they treat us and how we categorize them. Because these things aren't fixed. And we've seen that in politics, you know, we see it in our families, we see it in our workplace, and always relationships are changing all the time. So then, since there is such changeability, then we just have to look at our habit. You know, it's kind of like a habit that we have, being close to people who are nice to us and distant to people who aren't. I mean, when people do something we don't like, our habit can easily be to have kind of a reactive displeasure, you know, and get a little like, annoyed. But you also could create the habit to think, oh, they're suffering. And then you wouldn't be annoyed at all, because you'd see their suffering. So these things are habits, and we've had them for a long time, as Kapha said. And the Buddha said too. So just by these kind of reasonings, you can see that having equanimity and more impartiality is much more realistic. It's more realistic because it's more stable. It's just so unstable to follow these reactions that we have. Or in another way to look at it is to look at rebirth. If you know, it's helpful if you can wrap your mind around rebirth. So maybe you don't believe in it, but just pretend like it was true for a moment. And just think about how unstable relationships are if you think about it in terms of multiple lives. Because in one life, someone could have been your enemy, and the next life they could be your mother, and the next life they could be like a complete stranger. And they have that story of the one where the one monk or the, I guess this person who has clairvoyant powers or bodhisattva or somebody is sitting there with these people, kind of a rustic setting, and he's just laughing because he's seeing that they're cooking this fish and there's a dog there, and he's just laughing because the dog used to be this guy's father, and the fish used to be their child, and all these kind of things. You know, it's like now they're eating the child and kicking the dog. You know, it's just, you just don't know who. So how stable is that? You know. So if you think about beginningless time, then we've had countless relationships with everyone. Everyone in this room has probably murdered us and been our best friend and given us $1 million and, you know, have been complete strangers on different galaxies or something. You know, maybe we could have been in all kinds of relationships to each other. And here we are, all in this room today. Amazing. So how sensible is it, if that was the case, just say it's true for a moment, how sensible is it to hold some, okay, you're my friend because you're a monastic and you live with me. Last life, no, you are not my friend. I'll say, come on. How stable is that? So it just doesn't make any sense. All this, you know, affection that, you know, those that we like and those that we dislike, all that hostility and attachment and indifference, you know, regarding, you know, the one about indifference is, you know, we disregard the welfare of others because we don't know them. We don't know them. What does that mean? We know the most important thing about every living being, about every creature, you know, even earthworms, we know that they don't want to suffer. And we know that they want to be well. And we know that about every living being. And so I just love these ways of thinking because, you know, we don't know them, so we just get to disregard all the strangers. I mean, that makes no sense if you think about it in this light. So we know that all beings want to be happy and that no one wants to suffer. From the crickets to the beings in the formless realm or anywhere. So deep within every being's heart, we all have the same wish. So just like in that example that I gave very briefly this morning, imagine you were the charge nurse in a hospital and there's 10 patients there and they all want to get better. Are you just kind of like close the door on room 3 and 4 because they weren't nice to you today and just, no, let's not even give them their meals. You know, we'll just leave them there. They weren't nice to me today. No one would do that. You know, we have enough, just our basic human love and compassion that we have within us, and that sense of respect and care for others. We recognize that people suffer, and they want, you know, we don't want them to suffer, and they don't want to suffer. So we wouldn't do that. And it's just that same thought that we just take and we spread to everyone. So by looking at the faults of holding attachment and hostility and indifference, this is the way that we can release these emotions from our mind stream. And this is how we go about cultivating equanimity. I mean, it's so funny to talk about it like this because it sounds so ludicrous in a way. But it's what we do. You know. Anger is the one that is, you know, quite problematic, and it's hard to get rid of. It also does make us quite unhappy, so there's a little more motivation there for some. But if you have anger in your mind, you cannot be equanimous. And so we really have to work on that, letting go of any kind of grudges or resentments, even if we think we're right. It's not worth it. Just in the way that our community functions. I think we're at a place where we recognize that some things aren't worth it. And later, when we're out of that state, we realize we weren't so right anyway, but in the moment, we might feel quite right about something. And most of us, even in that moment, recognize harmony is so much more valuable than my way. And it just works so much better. So it's just really helpful to try to let go of those things. And if we can try to understand patience in the way that Shantideva talks about it, if we can really bring that in, then we will completely transform our minds, our heart and our mind. And, I mean, this is hard for me to... I mean, this time around of looking at this, it was a little easier, but this statement I always like, really? How? We can come to see enemies as even kinder than friends. They are like spiritual guides helping us along the path. Or like what Lama Zopa told to Venerable Children, who is kinder to you, your enemy or the Buddha? And his answer was, your enemy. Because only with the enemy can you develop patience, and only with patience can you make progress. We need to have patience in order, even to practice the Dharma, you have to develop patience or you won't continue. It's kind of troublesome sometimes, you know. And so it's why it's one of the, the six perfections. So when we have the situation of trying to be developing bodhicitta, trying to be following this path, then we can learn to see difficult people as actually the people who give us the opportunity. And this is true. They do test your inner strength. And they do test the power of your compassion. And they do it in a way that a spiritual teacher can't. That's true. So how do we use that experience is what it kind of comes down to. How do we even frame it? We can frame it as they're a jerk, or we can frame it as this is my opportunity to really learn something that's going to be beneficial, like all the way through the path to enlightenment. So I got one step farther on that one this time. So I've kind of found that a little beyond my comprehension. So, real bodhisattvas look forward to being harmed by others so they can practice patience. That's amazing. So when we work on developing equanimity, we usually do it in a certain order. They say it's easiest to start with neutral, people that you feel more neutral about, have neutral feelings about, and then friends or relatives. Then person that you have negative feelings towards, adverse feelings. So you usually do these things in order, kind of one by one, and then you try to spread it to all beings. So in each of the different meditations in this, they sometimes recommend a specific order because it just works better. So for equanimity, they actually start with someone that you have neutral feelings for, and that you can see makes some sense because you're not really attracted to them and not really so hostile, you're just kind of like a little more calm. So I think that when we do, even just did the meditation this morning on equanimity, did you find that it made your mind a little more peaceful to be able to set down some of the categories, some of this labeling? I did. So this doing that meditation can help the mind to be more peaceful, and also it can help us to be more considerate and thoughtful towards others. So that's partly because we are kind of letting go of exaggerating the good qualities and exaggerating the bad qualities. I think that's very helpful. So it's basically we're getting rid of various kinds of bias. So then you have still the conventional level of working with people. It doesn't mean you just throw open the doors and you trust everyone without any wisdom. You know, it's kind of like a difference between holding your mind inside, holding everyone in this life, and then going through your day and realizing you still have these conventional relationships with everyone. You're going to be closer in certain ways to people that you're around more. But even when people are difficult, you don't have to have the same reactions going on. It doesn't mean people on their side are necessarily going to change right away. You'll still be encountering everything. You don't just throw open the doors and let everybody move in. You have to still function in the world. And so it's a thing of trying to hold your mind in this attitude amidst everything that happens, so that when things happen, even watching yourself react, you don't have to follow that train of thought. You can just come back, no, I don't need to do that. This person's suffering, or however you can get yourself there. But I don't think it's good to have the idea that everything just becomes like a rosy apple pie, you know, because you've done this meditation. So I think it's I think that's helpful to think about, like, how for instance, strangers, are you just gonna, now that you've done this meditation, you see everyone as equal, you're just gonna give some complete stranger the keys to your house? That would be too wise. Well, it's not really saying that. So that's kind of the general background. And then in this chapter, from Taming the Mind, they focus on the seven cause and effect instructions. And so I'll review those again. The first six are causes, and then the seventh is like the result or the effect of the first six. So the first is seeing all sentient beings as having been our mother, recalling their kindness to us. This is our second point. The third is wishing to repay it. And these three are the base that are like everything else relies upon, the actual, their attitudes that we generate. What actually causes us, what actually brings us to the place of compassion is we get to the place of that heartfelt love. And then from there, we'll either go to love or compassion, which it will come differently for different people. But basically, step four is love, step five is compassion, although they might be reversed depending on the person. The sixth thing is this great resolve, and then the seventh is the bodhicitta, the altruistic intention. So, does everybody have those, or should I repeat them one more time? Point one, seeing all sentient beings as having been our mother. Two, recalling their kindness to us. Three, wishing to repay it. Four, love. Five, compassion. Six, great resolve. Seven, the altruistic intention of bodhicitta. So we've talked about some of these already. The first one, seeing all sentient beings as having been our mother. This means equally. This helps us to see everyone equally because they've all been our mother. So if you don't believe in rebirth, just play with it and see what effect it has on your mind. Just trying to, just considering the possibility that everyone's been your mother or someone close to you before, and just see if that can help you to develop a feeling of closeness. And with the feeling of closeness, it's easier to trust people. And then it's also easier to give them the benefit of the doubt when our mind is like that, you know. We're much less reactive. And this isn't very easy. Although the Buddha did say, he said, monastics, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. It's not easy, monastics, to find a being who in this long course has not previously been your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter. For what reason? Because, monastics, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. And that's what the Buddha said. So then once you've kind of worked with that, then spend some time on step two, recalling the kindness of sentient beings when they were your mother. And so this, you know, if you or your caretaker, whoever was helpful and that you feel some closeness. So we want to really bring to mind all of the many kindnesses that, you know, who brought us up, what they did when we were young, as infants and as children. Because most people regard that person as extremely dear and close. And so we want to develop this awareness of the kindness of others by doing this. We've received much kindness. So we can take a lot of these things for granted, of course. All the changing of diapers and teaching us how to tie our shoes and how to speak and schlepping us off to school and buying us clothes and toys and sending us off to college and all kinds of things. But if we think about it in the right frame of mind, we can actually open our hearts to a feeling of gratitude, which really, I think, is something that as adults, especially, we need, you know, it's a healthy thing as an adult to have this sense of gratitude for things and closeness. And then we want to kind of bring that on and recognize that since everyone has been our mother, then even strangers we can have that sense of closeness to, and even enemies, people currently that you are not so cheery with, they were kind to you in the past when they were your parents. So we try to use that awareness and then bring it to all sentient beings. So in this part of the meditation, you usually start with the parent, and then you go to the strangers, then to the enemies, then to all beings. Recognizing that they've all been kind to you, they've all been your mother in the past, they'll all be your mother again in the future until you free yourself from samsara. And then you're open to this kind of gratitude. So then the third step is repaying their kindness. And this is just automatic. It's the great thing. I think I even think you might see this in other creatures too. If you look in the animal realm, I think some of this might be demonstrated, but it's definitely in the human realm that it's just automatic and natural to have this sense of wanting to repay others' kindness. And so how do we do that? Do we just wish them to have a nice house on the hill and three cars in the garage and a good bank account? What happiness, what kindness do we want them to have? And this is where we recall the various meditations we've done throughout the year already, looking at the disadvantages of psychic existence. And we see that just wishing them this kind of mundane temporal happiness has no real essence. Although it's good, you know, it's nice. I think it's great to wish people these things. We also want to open up to a greater possibility. So we bring back, I think, some of the verses that help us, like from the three principal aspect. Swept by the current of the four powerful rivers, tied by the strong bonds of karma, which are so hard to undo, caught in the iron net of self-grasping egoism, completely enveloped by the darkness of ignorance, born and reborn in boundless psychic existence, unceasingly tormented by the three sufferings, by thinking of all mother sentient beings in this condition, generate a supreme altruistic intention. So another verse that talks about this is, says, our mothers, blinded by ignorance and wounded by karma, wander near the precipice of unfortunate rebirths, aimlessly searching for happiness where there are only deceptive illusions. We must help them to be free from samsara. So I think that's kind of the bigger perspective of what, how we might want to repay kindness. So those first three are the base, the basis that, of these kind of intentions. And then the next are the actual techniques. Steps four beyond are the actual techniques. And why is that? It's because we had to get to this point of this heartwarming love where we feel this closeness. And then we can actually be in a position to really open up to love and compassion. So this, because it will naturally arise then. You see people as kind and dear, it's easy then to move into these next steps. And so the fourth step is love. So this is a little bit different. We're not now talking about that heartwarming love. This is one, the heartwarming love, if you've done these other three steps or thought about it through the other method, you've gotten yourself to that point. There's nothing else you need to do then. But now when we move on to this kind of love, the definition of love in Buddhism is wishing others to have happiness and the causes of happiness. And we consciously cultivate this. For some other people, it will more naturally arise that they'll move to compassion first. They'll have this feeling of closeness and they'll see the suffering that someone's having and they'll be more moved to wish, the definition of compassion is wishing others to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So it kind of depends on how we're looking at things. Is that we wanting somebody to be happier, or is it we just kind of want to, don't we see they're being burdened and we want to remove their burdens? I find that to be true for myself. It's much easier for me to think about it from the compassion side. It's much easier for my mind to see suffering and someone suffering and want to remove it. I think for me, love is quite so mishmashed with attachment. It's hard to get a clear view on that one. Well, that's my little thing. Okay, so when we do the meditation on love, they usually have you start, you understand what it is. You're wanting people to be happy. You have the causes of happiness. And then you first start with friends, then usually people that you have neutral feelings towards, then enemies, and then all beings. And you want to wish them all levels of happiness, mundane, spiritual. And so when you do this, it can be very expansive, because you can, just like the teachings we've been having, you can wish beings to have anything and everything. And then in Mahayana Buddhism, love and compassion, they have this expression, great love and great compassion. And so these are a little bit different from our ordinary sense, because these are more unbiased, like what we were talking about, more impartial. We've kind of removed attachment, which is not how we usually go about love. It's a more genuine type of love, where you're more focused on the others. It doesn't have anything to do with what they're doing for you. It's quite focused on the other. And we extend it towards everyone. And the way we get to that, going from the ordinary, we could see when we thought about the 10 hospital patients, we don't want them to suffer. We have a certain kind of compassion, and we have a certain level of love within us. But now we need to mix that. It's like, that's like a seed that we have. Now we need to grow that into great love and great compassion. And that we do by throwing in a little bit of wisdom, where we try to remove the attachment that we have that's mixed in there, or the partiality. I love you, but only if you do this. I love only people who have blue eyes and not brown eyes. I love, So we extend it towards everyone. And then we also are doing it very consciously. We're not like relying on a spontaneous thing here. It's nice if that happens, but we're actually cultivating it with a clear purpose. So when we mix wisdom with our love and compassion, it will be much more stable, and it will have a lot less to do with other people's behavior. So then moving on to compassion. So we need to have that sense of closeness, and we need to have a concern for suffering. So we need to understand suffering, which we've talked about in previous weeks. Now, this is where he kind of grows it to me. And I guess this really depends on how well we... really, those two things. If you had a sense of closeness and you had a really deep understanding of suffering, this next part would be easy, I think. When we find other beings tormented, when we find they're being tormented by suffering unbearable, then the compassion that we have can lead us to the great resolve. That's what we're trying to go to. So that, I found some people suffering rather unbearable in the past. But I didn't have the view of liberation in mind. I was really thinking about this morning. In fact, I've been kind of pondering this, like why I had trouble with this. And I think what I realized this morning is that what's hard for me is, what can I do comes to mind. And I feel like I can't do anything. And then I go to like this hopeless feeling, And then I don't even want to get involved then. This is what I've been kind of looking at in myself. And then this morning when I was doing the Chinrin Zen practice, I was still kind of like, I don't know if I was conscious of that, but that's what runs in my mind. What can I do? Well, Chinrin Zen, it's got it all worked out for us here. This will work. Think about somebody you've really tried to help. Okay, let's just pretend we have this light that we can shine on people, and it will do something. So first, what if you purified any being who was suffering of all their disturbing attitudes and all their negativities of body, speech, and mind? Okay, that would be a great start. You know? And then now the light goes and it gives them every temporal happiness. That would be kind of nice too. They wouldn't be suffering from all the things. Even if they got rid of everything that was disturbing attitude, they still might be in poverty. And now you've given them stability of food and all the requisites. And now the light goes out again and you give them all the realizations of the path and take them all the way to enlightenment. It's like, oh, thanks. What can I do? Shine the light. This is why you gotta become a Buddha. So if it becomes unbearable, I think it's because we haven't gotten to the place yet of seeing what the Buddhas do. So when you do the meditation on compassion, you start with dear ones. And you think of someone who's suffering in such a way that you cannot bear that he or she is in such a miserable condition. And then you do that with people who are neutral, and then people that you have difficulty with, and then finally everyone. And when we do this meditation, it's really easy to make the mistake of kind of doing it to all sentient beings, which is like nobody, like this amorphous thing. It's really good to think about people that you know, especially, you know, like, of course, start how they say with people who are dear, but really think of specific people and then start thinking about people you have difficulty with. Don't just think about somebody who's halfway across the earth that you don't know at all, or just everyone. So you want to start small with maybe 1, 2, 3, but make it very specific and then try to build it towards all beings. And then once you've done this in a very personal way and you reach this feeling of compassion or of love, either of these, this is where you bring in the single point of concentration. When you generate that feeling and you've done the meditation, the conclusion is to dwell in that feeling. And so with whatever concentration you have in that moment, when that feeling arises of compassion or of love, then you try to hold, just stay with it. That's how we do analytical meditations that kind of go that direction. And this is important to do repeatedly over extended time from many perspectives. It won't work just to do it, you know, briefly. You know, a weekend retreat won't do it. And Tsongkhapa said, "You will not achieve anything with unclear experiences that come when you make a short, concentrated effort without precisely clarifying the topic with your understanding." He said that's true for other kinds of practice. He was talking about these practices. You have to be very clear about what you're trying to do. Really, you're trying to generate experiences in your mind stream so that then when you get off the cushion, you can kind of put these things into action. But this is talking about on the cushion. So you're very clear about what you're trying to generate, what experience. And then you can't be unrealistic and think, you know, you can do this in 2 weeks. When you get to the point six, the great resolve, year by year, we look for these things to change. You go, you know, don't be in any hurry. But we get to the point where we want to be involved, essentially. We want to bring this about. And this kind of resolve of taking what the great resolve defined is the determination to assume the responsibility to bring sentient beings happiness and eliminate their suffering. So it's like a heartfelt commitment that we make. And so we have to prepare ourselves fully in order to do that. And that's why we choose to practice the Mahayana path, to abandon our negativities and enhance our good qualities. So we have to really have a clear understanding of what the Buddha is, what kind of qualities we're trying to develop. And then those are the six causes, and bingo, point seven, bodhicitta. So Tsongkhapa defines bodhicitta as the wish to attain the highest enlightenment, the object of attainment, for the sake of all sentient beings, the object of intent. So that when we finally get to the point of having spontaneous bodhicitta, it won't be solid yet. We can still lose it. So we have to, we try to get to the point. Right now we just are cultivating it through sitting here reasoning like this and getting to a place where, yeah, I want to do that, you know. So we cultivate it. We fabricate it. But at some point, when as we keep doing this, it will be spontaneous, and then still there'll be the need to continue to cultivate that till it's stable and firm. And that will be in the middle of the first path. So you become a bodhisattva when you have spontaneous bodhicitta. That's the moment you become. So we'll just sit for a minute. Pick out one or two points that you want to remember. And then let's give away any of the positive potential from sharing this morning to any being who is suffering mentally or physically. And let's think about especially people who are in fear for any reason right now, maybe in hospitals, maybe without a job, maybe wondering how long their money's going to last, where they're going to live. Maybe they don't even have a place to live. And let's give everything positive away so that we can be in better circumstances immediately. And may we all become Buddhas so that we can help every being to be free of every suffering. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase for